December 2nd, Rosh Chodesh. Welcome everyone. Okay, let's get right to it. I want to pick up, a lot of people were interested, emailed me about the clip I showed from Reuven Feinstein last week. So, a little surprised maybe at how strong he was. Let me, explain how I see this. And I mentioned this to someone in the family who emailed me. Basically, let's set the scene again. You have a guy. It was a Torah Masorah conference from 2 weeks ago. So you have a guy who asked a question. It's a chutzpahic question, but the guy didn't mean to be chutzpahic. He just didn't realize. I mean, he sees Reuven Feinstein with the long coat. He doesn't realize he doesn't wear the tzitzis out. So the question is, like we all know with children, we have questions. Like, at what age do you tell a child, not to play with toys that make, electronic noises? Is it four? Is it six? So there's an age, but of course we know you're not supposed to play with that when it makes those noises. At what age do you put tzitzis on a child? I mean, because you know that they're supposed to wear tzitzis. So the question was, at what age should you tell the child to wear the tzitzis out? The implication of the question is that the only way to be a religious Jew is to wear the tzitzis out. Now here, Reuven Feinstein, I mean, he doesn't wear it out, and his father didn't wear it out, and all the gedolim, like he knew from yesteryear, didn't wear it out either. Maybe Rav Aaron Cutler did. I'm still waiting to determine, but certainly we know from the Lithuanian, the Musar schools, they didn't. So that's why he gets all upset, and he's like, throwing it at the guy, because this is implication that unless you do that, you're really not living up to the way you should religiously. Now, please text me or email me the people who listen to it, because maybe take a yeshivish community, Passaic, Muncie, wherever. Is it the case where all the rebbeim, where that sits us out? If that's the case, then you can see how the young people, they're going to grow up naturally. They're going to wear it like that because the model for them is the Rebbe, and the Rebbe wears it like that. I didn't have that growing up. I think in elementary and high school, I think of only one or maybe two rebbeim who wore the tzitzis out, but the others absolutely didn't. So we never would have, because that would have been viewed, the expression as yuhara. It's like, who are we? We're being more pious than the rabbis. And but this somehow changed. And look, I learn with a group of guys from the more right-wing world, and with one exception, as far as I see, I think they're all wearing the tzitzis out. So there's been a change, obviously. So that's why I think, that's how I at least see Reuven Feinstein, why his response was so harsh. And if you haven't seen the video, watch last class, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Okay. I want to make one more thing. I also want to mention about of what we saw. We ended last class with Rav Moliver, who was in London, and the Machzikei Hadas controversy I mentioned a little about. And you can hear more about it if you go to the classes on Rav Yitzchak Spector. I did it also about Rav Yechezkel Abramsky. In fact, Rabbi Dov sent me a. Sent me something from Rav Matisyahu Solomon, where he talks about what I mentioned, how Rav Yechezkel Abramsky suffered from the people who thought he was a traitor for joining the United Synagogue based in, not remaining in Machzikei Hadas. He sent me this passage that Rav Yechezkel Abramsky said that Chaim Moshe Grodzinski himself asked him to do this. And he didn't reveal this because he didn't want the Kanaim to attack Rav Chaim Oster, so he was willing to be the one attacked himself. But I mentioned that Rav Moliver was in London. He went to London to raise money and to change minds about Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And while there, he was asked to intervene in this dispute, the Machzikei Hadas. They formed their own community, their own shlita, and based upon what he wrote, Rav Yitzchak Chanan assured the Machzikei Hadas. Now, here's the text, and I have to give a lot of credit to Bernard Homa. Bernard Homa includes not just the pro Machzikei Hadas, he's a descendant of the founder of Machzikei Hadas, but he includes everything, all the documents against the Machzikei Hadas. So here you have the letter of Yitzchak Chanan. Later, he includes other letters. So the Netziv came out against them. A lot of people came out against them. Of course, in all these matters, you're always going to have people on the opposite side. So Yitzhak Hanan says that that for this community to set up their own shchita, their own even their own community is asor b'isur gamor. It's absolutely forbidden. And I'm assuming he agreed with the formulation of here it is from the chief rabbinate in their Dayani. Here you see it that any meat sold by the Mechziki Hadas is treif and prohibited to be eaten. So what does that really mean, though, when you declare that this new community, their shlita, is no good? Like I told you, Tzipi and Frank wanted Reb Chaim Ozer to declare that the Eda Charedit shlita is pasul. What does that mean to declare it is treif? Does that mean, therefore, let's say I was living in London, the end of the 19th century, and I took a piece of meat and I cooked it in a pot, and then later someone came in and said, "Oh, that's the Machzik Hadas meat," and you're not allowed to eat that. Does that mean it's treif in the sense that it actually treifs off the pots and I have to kosher the pot? I don't see how that there could be a basis for saying that. The way I understand it, even when they say it's treif, they mean in the sense that you can't eat it. And what's the basis of not eating it? Because we have to listen to what the rabbonim say, but not that it's actually tarfus and that you've trafed up your pots and anything like that. If I'm wrong, if anyone disagrees, let me know. But I can't see how, not to mention the fact there's all the other Gedolim who disagree with it, but even if they didn't, even if all the Gedolim came out uniform with a takana that you can't eat from this shchita. And we have this today as well. We spoke earlier about in Long Island, this new hashkacha, the Mahadran Hashkacha, where the Vod declared it Usur. So what, but it doesn't really mean that you're actually have eaten treif. It's you've gone against, at least that's how I understand all these decrees. You've gone against, if you want to be part of a community, you should follow the rabbanim of the community. And you could violate the laws that talk about how you have to listen to the judge in your day. And but so they could say it's as if you're eating treif, but it's not actually treif to the extent that your kalim are no good. That's at least how I understand it. I'll get to the comments at the end as always. Okay, the other big issue that was taking place at this time, 1889 to 1888 to 1890, that is the Jewish year, Tafresh Memchet, Tafresh Memtes, which was a Shemitah year. And we actually have a report of a meeting in Vilna where the Shemitah issue was discussed. And among the Rabbanim who were at the meeting, there was also lay people, three big Rabbanim. One was Reb Oliver, the other was the Netziv, and the other was Reb Mordechai Eliasberg. Mordechai Eliasberg, not really well known today, but a leading Rav in Chov Beis Zion. He was also Rav in the city of Bausk. Bausk is an important city because that's where Rav Kook was Rav of later. But Rav Eliasberg, the text we have, which appears in the Sefer Shmuel, that's the memorial volume for Reb Oliver, we have that the leader of the lay people, basically, of Chov Beis Zion, turned to the rabbis and say to them that we need to find some heter because the people living in Eretz Yisrael that depend on the land, working the land. What does the Netziv reply? The Netziv replies that the Torah tells us that we can't work the land, and therefore, by not working the land without finding ways to get around this, we will show our obedience to God. Rav Moliver, he at this meeting was he didn't know exactly. He's in the middle somewhere. He says we have to. He says he thinks it's possible we can find a heter, but we have to think about it whether we should use this heter because thousands. He says 1,000 years. We haven't. It's probably more than that. We haven't dealt with the issue of Shemitah. That's really not true because they had Jews had. We know that because a few hundred years ago, one of the Sephardic Rabbanim also came up with the same heter to sell the land. So we know that Jews also had land, but he thought at least 1,000 years. It could be, I think it means 1,000. Maybe it's 2,000. There's no nekudos here. I don't know if it's actually, no, it's not Aleph. It's Alpayim. 2,000 years that we didn't fulfill this mitzvah. And now, thank God, we have the ability to fulfill the mitzvah. We have to attempt to do so. So he's in the middle. Because he also acknowledges that we can find a heter if we need to. And then he reports that Reb Mordechai Eliasberg, with a lot of enthusiasm, says that my opinion is absolutely different. Efshar limso heter, he said, we can find a heter. And Rav Oliver agrees. And if we're able to be matir, asur aleinu, it's forbidden for us to put in danger, that is, if there's a possibility of a heter, Rav Eliasberg says, we need to use the heter, because aleinu atir b'rishum pikpuk, or atir ad kamash efshar, ki lo devar katan hu adbar zeh. Because he's saying basically the livelihood, the whole, not just the livelihood, but the whole existence of the yishuv, hachadash here, depends on allowing them to work the land. So we have three opinions. Rav Moliver in the middle, who thinks it's very important not to rely on the heter, although we could if we needed to. Netziv says absolutely not. Rav Eliasberg, who says no, we absolutely must. Rav Moliver was convinced by Rav Eliasberg, and he would become a supporter, not just a supporter, a leading supporter of the Heter Mechira, selling the land to non-Jews, Arabs, Muslims. They have to be Muslims. The reason they have to be Muslims is as follows. To this day, or if not Muslims, Druze, the halacha is you can't sell land in the land of Israel to a non-Jew. But you see, if you look at the explanations, one of the explanations given is that we don't want the non-Jews to bring their idolatry into the land. Well, if that's the reason for it, that so that the non-Jews won't bring their idolatry into the land, well, then if you're dealing with non-Jews who do not worship Avodah Zarah, then there wouldn't be a problem to sell that, because the whole basis of it, it's always tricky to know when the reason, when the halacha depends on the reason and when not. But if the point of the mitzvah is that they're not supposed to bring Avodah Zarah into the land, then these people don't worship Avodah Zarah, then you'd be able to sell it to them. Like you can sell it to a Ger Toshav, let's say. So you could sell it to a non-Jew who's not an idolater, and they even want to say has a status of a Ger Toshav. So, and that's how it continues to this day. So, Rav Moliver was actually one of the people who turned to Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. Who was Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector? We've said it a million times. The greatest Torah sage in Lithuania. I think I've told you. I mean, I've said this in my lectures a lot, but I don't know if I've said it in the classes. I used to say Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector was the Godol Hador. And then I learned that they're Sephardic Jews. What do they know? They don't know Rav Yitzchak Yochanan. They have the Ben Ishchai. They have others. Okay, so I said he's the Godel of the Ashkenazim. But of course, you have the Hasidim, and they have their post-scheme. And so we're stuck with saying he's the Godel Hador of the Litvish, the Lithuanians. And for many of you, you think that's where the Torah comes from anyway, so the others don't matter. So, but in any event, he's certainly a great authority, no question about it. And the final word for the Litvish community, unless you decide he's not the final word. Like if you really were committed to the Machzikei Hadas, the fact that Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector said, so look, you can't just reject Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. If you look at the way that they reject him, they don't just say, well, we don't accept him. They have to say things like, well, Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector wasn't given all the facts. He thinks that the chief rabbinate of England and they're based in is really first rate, but really they're relying on all sorts of kulas, and the kashrus is very weak, and therefore we need to improve it. And if Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan really knew the situation, he never would have come to this conclusion. That's what you have to say about Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan. You can't just say he's wrong and we reject him. And that's what all the rabbis writing about say. But it was Rav Moliver who turned to the great Rav Yitzchak Yochanan, and Rav Yitzchak Yochanan gave the famous heter to sell the land to non-Jews. And the basis of this heter is that Shemitah today, according to most, in fact, according to the overwhelming majority, is at best only a derabbanan, a rabbinic law. And therefore, we can find ways to get out of it if necessary. There is an opinion even by the Baal Amor, Miri mentions others, who hold that it's not even a law at all. It's just a minhag. Look, there's also a law that you can't sell land to non-Jews in Israel. And this has nothing to do with Shemitah. So the Netziv famously replied, fine, you're getting out of Shemitah because it's only Durabanan. And since it's an emergency measure time, Shas HaVachak, you want a heter, then its attitude is fine if you find a heter, but the heter you found is even worse because you've jumped from like the fire into the fire. Yeah. You jump from whatever it is, I forget now, into the fire because Shemitah is only Durabanan. So you find a heter, but the answer to this heter is to sell the land to the non-Jews, and that's midiraisa forbidden. That's what the Netziv says, because the Netziv says it doesn't matter if they're Ovdei or not, from the firing pan into the fire. It's from the frying pan, yes, into the fire. Thank you. But it was a shas adchak. It wasn't just a shas adchak, an emergency measure, because literally the yeshuv could collapse. The people, they would starve, and they'd have to leave Eretz Yisrael, and it wouldn't work. Especially since the Baron Rothschild said he would stop his monetary support for the settlements under his control. Not all the settlements were under his control, but some of them were. If he says if they didn't find a heter for the sabbatical year, he would stop his monetary support. And we saw last class how was it Gedera, right? I think it was Gedera, that even though Maskeret Batya, by the way, Maskeret Batya, one or two of you pointed out this, which hold on a second. I gotta find you here. Here it is. Mention, and one of you mentioned in class, but here, this book. It happens to be, I forgot to mention it in last class, so reminded me. This is actually a great book, published by Feldheim, which doesn't really publish. They used to publish all sorts of academic type works, but not anymore. But this is actually a really good book. Rebels in the Holy Land, Maskeret Batya, and Roy Battleground for the Soul of Israel. It has all the sources from the old Hebrew newspapers. I don't know who Sam Finkel is. It says, as it's described, do you know how pivotal a role the fervently Orthodox played in the early farming of the Holy Land? This is their true story. When a determined band of Russian Jewish farmers arrived in Palestine in 1882, they knew the world would be watching. In one of Baron Edmund de Rothschild's most daring experiments, their task was to build a Jewish agricultural colony. The farmer's simple wish to observe the sabbatical year of 1889 to 1890. Actually, I said 1888 to 1889, so I'm wrong. Despite their patrons' opposition, thrust them into the swirling epicenter of worldwide controversy. Reviled by the Baron's administrators, vilified in the press, ridiculed and nearly abandoned by some of the religious countrymen, they stood firm. Actually, I think this is wrong. The Shemitah is for 1888 to 1899. This is a mistake right here. You can check it to be sure, but I'm positive it's Tav Resh Mem Chet. It's Tav Resh Mem Tet. So that's Maskeret, that's what we spoke about last class. So the Baron wouldn't support them. Let's see. So it's a Shas HaTchak. Now, the important figures who dealt with this were all in Chovei Tzion. Who were they? The Netziv, Rav Molliber, and Rav Mordechai Eliasberg, I already mentioned, but others as well. The Heter Mechira of Rav Yitzchok Yochanan Spector would split the Chovei Tzion rabbis into two opposing camps. The Netziv, not the only the Netziv, but he's the leading figure, and he was very active in Chovei Tzion. He opposes it. I mean, basically, like I said, he said, we now finally have the opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah. We have to do it in the proper form. He saw return to Eretz Yisrael as a great merit, a great zechus. And we're not, the returnees had to observe halacha to be so worthy. He thought that if they followed the law, the charitable donations will come in. And that's not going to be a problem. But there's a dispute, as we saw. So you have the Netziv, but you also have Rav Molliber and Roy Eliasberg. And that's why Rav Molliber and his side turned to Rav Yitzchok Yochanan. After acquainting himself with the situation, now you could say that he was fed false information by the Molliver. That's what they're going to say, of course, the opponents. But after acquainting himself with the situation, being influenced by the Chovei Tzion and their rabbinic backers, which included his son, we remember it's Tzvi Rabinowitz. We know him from the Mussar controversy, the anti-Mussar figure, and he supported the Heter Mechira of Tzvi Rabinowitz. Rav Yitzchok Yochanan was ready to issue the heter. I'm sure there are people who, in opposition, who claimed that Rav Yitzchok Yochanan was unduly influenced by his son, just like they say Rav Moshe Feinstein was unduly influenced by his son-in-law on all these medical issues. They always come up with these sorts of things. But after hearing it, Rav Yitzchok Yochanan was ready to issue the heter, which he did. However, he received a letter. I mean, issuing the heter is one thing, but who's going to sell the land?
the land has to be sold, and presumably you want it to be sold on the spot in Eretz Yisrael. You're not going to have someone in Kovno sell the land. Now, Rav Yitzchak Spector received a letter from Rav Shmuel Salant and Yeshua Diskin, and who were the two leading rabbis in Jerusalem. With Rav Diskin, more extreme of the two, Rav Shmuel Salanto was the mainstream Rav of the community for the Ashkenazim. And they wrote to Ritz Ochanan saying, do not issue the Heter Mechira, as this would be a great breach. Now, there's this difficult relationship between the new Yishuv and the old Yishuv, even at the beginning. Rav Salant was the Marad Asra. So how can you issue a Heter Mechira when the Marad Asra opposes it? And Rav Diskin, of course, was a very important rabbi. That should have been the end of the discussion, you would think. When the Marad Asra, but here we get into the question. Is Rabbi Shmuel Salant the Marad Asra, the Rav of Eretz Yisrael? Or is he only the Rav of the old Yishuv in Jerusalem, the old-timers, the ones who are supported by the Chalukah system, whereas these new people coming, creating settlements, working for a living, who says that he's the Marad Asra for them? As the year 1888 went on until the end of 1888, when it becomes the, you know, Rosh Hashanah becomes the Shemitah year, the people involved in Chibat Zion, the Chovei Zion, started to get very worried. They claimed that this was an issue of real pikuach nefesh, and that the choice was either people will starve to death or the settlements will close up. And there's no hope, they said, to actually raise money charity. And they needed an answer, and they needed an answer soon, before it began, the year began. Rav Moliver was able to get two other Gedolim, not Rav Eliasberg, two other Gedolim, recognized Gedolim, to write to Rav Yitzchak Chanan. One was Rishol Yoshua Trunk, Rav of Kutna, author of the Yeshua's Malko. It's a important commentary on the Mishneh Torah. He's one of the big Rabbonim, and also a leading Rav in Warsaw. There wasn't a chief rabbi in Warsaw, but a leading Rav Warsaw, Rav Shmuel Zenville Klatfish. He's the one I mentioned, the father-in-law of Rav Shlomo David Kahana, who is also a big Rav in Warsaw, and then becomes Rav of the Old City. All three of these, Rav Moliver, Rav Klatfish, and Rav Trunk, were outstanding Torah scholars, and they decided, actually, I shouldn't even say before they wrote to Yitzchak Chanan, they decided, the three of them, on their own, they're going to issue the Heter. Whether Yitzchak Chanan issues it or not, they're going to issue the Heter. And the contract itself was to be done by the Beis Din of Jerusalem. But it was to be done, so which Beis Din? It was to be done on the authority of the rabbis. The authority of these rabbis. And the Beis Din in Jerusalem, which Beis Din is going to be a question, because, you know, you have the main Beis Din, but you could have other Batei Din. They also said that the Heter is dependent on Rav Yitzchak Chanan. And they sent him a documentation. So they weren't asking Rav Yitzchak Chanan necessarily to come out with his own Heter. They were asking him a little less to at least ex post facto approve of the Heter issued by these three Gedolim. But the fact is, they put Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spector on the spot. Because although it's true that he was not responsible for the Heter, they were saying that, you know, this is necessary. We need a Heter, and we're not going to do it without you. So maybe it made his position even more difficult. And he went along with it. He wrote that not only did he agree to the Heter, he even wrote a letter affirming it, stressing that the sale must only be to Muslims. And the necessity of the sale is because the value, we need to have a yeshuv in Eretz Yisrael, and without this, the people, the whole, the settlements will have to close, and the people will starve if they still remain there, and if they don't remain there, they're going to have to leave and close it up, and that's, Eretz Yisrael is also very important. He said that he wrote a kuntres. Rav Yitzchak Chanan tells us that he wrote an entire kuntres. That's like a longer than a tshuva, I figure 20, 30 pages, whatever it is, but he never published it. Because he didn't want to be, he said, the only one to permit. I don't know what that means, the only one to permit, because you have these three rabbis also permit, but, oh no, sorry, let me take that back. He said in his letter, he says that he had already written a kuntres, but he didn't publish it, because he didn't want to be the one to permit. But now that he sees the other Gedolim, Rav Klepfish, Rav Trunk and Rav Molliver have come out and given a heter and only waiting for his approval. Therefore, he's going along with the heter, but it's only good for Tafresh Mem tests for 1889, 1888, 1889. In future Shemitahs, he says we have to re-examine the issue again. So where's the Kuntress? Where's the Chon Inspector? Where he explained why it's permissible to sell the land. Well, this was a mystery. Everyone is, no one really knew what happened to it. Well, I can tell you, I don't know in what where it now is. Presumably it was lost to time, but we have a letter of Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski to Rav Chilak of Weinberg, and Rav Chaim Ozer would be in position to know, who says that Rav Yitzchak Elchanan did not publish this responsum, this kuntres, because he didn't want it to be a psak ledorot for the generations. It was for this year, 1889, but every time, every Shemitah, you have to revisit it again. He thought that if he put it in writing, then it would assume a more permanent status, and he understood, Ritzel Chanan, more than the other rabbis, that this heter is on very shaky ground. And once it's, you put it in writing, then everyone starts relying on it, and no, he wanted it almost like from scratch, the lundus, to be, to again, start it over again and see if it's applicable. The reason would be, Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski told us Reb Chiyak of Weinberg is because he told that Reb Chiyak of Weinberg wrote this in 1933, 1934, when the Nazis banned Shlita. So Rabbi Weinberg wrote it without stunning beforehand. Rabbi Weinberg writes a long tshuva, a heter, to stun animals before Shlita, which he never published because Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski basically forbid him to publish it. He only would publish it when the first volume of Stradiyesh appeared in the early 1960s. And Rav Chaim Ozer told him that you're in good company, that Rav Yitzchak Elchanan didn't publish it, and for the same reason, that you don't want to put this into print, something which then could become a basis for the future, rather than as a heter, like a regel achas on one foot, this will become more permanent. And in fact, when the Stradiyesh from Rav Weinberg published his responsum, people protested. They said that now you, they said Rav Chaim Ozer told you not to. He explains in the introduction why he feels now he can. But there was opposition to him because they said that now you're going to give ammunition to the enemies, the ones who want to ban Shlita. If they see that there's a great rabbi who says it's permissible, then you're giving them ammunition. Now, as you can imagine, the rabbis in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Salant, Rav Diskin, were very upset when this heter came out from the three rabbis and Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector giving his imprimatur, because I mean, and rightfully so, when you think about it, how can outside rabbis, even great rabbis, give up psak for the land of Israel when they're not there? I think from the standpoint of these rabbis, the attitude was that the rabbis in Jerusalem, they were out of touch with this idea of settlements and of farming and all that. That was not in their mindset. And therefore, they didn't appreciate what was happening. And they weren't going to let the fate of the Jewish people rest on these rabbis, who, by the way, had a conception that you're not supposed to work in the land of Israel. Their whole idea was that we're going to be supported by tzedakah from Chutz La'aretz. And like I said, they were not so Shmo Salant, for all his greatness, and he was great. He was not the Marad Asr for the new colonies. That's the fact. Okay, so what about, though, the Beis Din? You need to have the Beis Din. The Heter stated that it would have to be the Heter by the three rabbis and then affirmed by Ritz Elchanan that it would have to be put into effect by practice by a Beis Din in Jerusalem. And practically, that was the only way for it to work. You know, the people in Jerusalem will find the Arab to sell it to. You can't really do that unless you're on the spot. And so how could you do that if a Rassant or a Diskin were opposed to it? They actually organized a Vod HaShemitah. And they said that they'll raise the money to support the few colonists who actually did observe it. Now, the fact is that some of those who tried to observe Shemitah were not able to continue. And the Netziv, who was a strong opponent of the Heter, writes that we cannot reproach the people of Gedera who are not able to complete the year observing Shemitah. Maskeret Batya, as far as I know, completed it and were supported. But Gedera began to observe Shemitah, but I don't know all of them, but many of them couldn't make it, and they relied on the Heter Mechira. And the Netziv, a great opponent, says that we cannot rebuke them because we're not in their place. And you know, if these are people who were authentically interested in not relying on the Heter, it must have been a real Shas HaDachak, Pikuach Nefesh for them to do that. But okay, so which Beit Din? The only Beit Din in Jerusalem with any authority is the Ashkenazic Beit Din there, and they won't help with the Heter Mechira. Well, there actually is another Beit Din. There's only Ashkenazic Beit Din of authority wouldn't help, but there's also a Sephardic Beit Din. The Sephardic Beit Din is led by a big Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Yaakov Shaul El Yashar. He's known as the Yisa Ish, from his volume of Tshuvos, Yisa, Yaakov Shaul El Yashar, a great, great authority, written many volumes of Tshuvot and other things. Jose Faur, for some reason, in his new book that just came out, it's a collection of a number of published things. It's like 1,500 pages. They're going to be publishing all of his writings and some unpublished stuff. So in that book, he says that Rav Yaakov Shaul El Yashar was an Ashkenazi. Now, I don't know where he gets this from. Yaakov Shaul, I looked into it. Not on his mother's side, not his father's side. As far as I can tell, there's no Ashkenazic. But Yaakov Shaul El Yashar was the Rishon LeZion. Rishon LeZion is the position that goes back hundreds of years of the head of the Jewish community. Ashkenazim are latecomers to this. And he agreed to the sale. Sephardim are sometimes more liberal on these matters, as we know. And it's funny because, you know, for the Sephardim, you're living in Eastern Europe, you never met a Sephardim. It's very exotic, the Sephardim. They build them up in their minds as, you know, such these great figures, which some of them were and some of them weren't. But Rav Trunk writes that we can rely on, he goes overboard. He said we can rely on Rav El Yashar because the Sephardic rabbis are much greater than the Ashkenazic rabbis. It's this, like I said, it's this exotic, you know, idea that, you know, they've never met them, but they're imagining them as living in the land of Israel, much greater than the Ashkenazim. So that's what he says. And the Sephardic Beit Din of Rav El Yashar arranged sale for the Ashkenazi colonists. That's that. I could see how if you were Rabbi Shmuel Salant or Rav Diskin, you'd see this as very subversive. You're undermining the authority of the Ashkenazim, but okay. And the Sephardic Beit Din is on good grounds because there was a Sephardi Rav in Hebron a couple of hundred years before. His Sefer Tshuvos is called the Shemen HaMaor. He permitted the sale of land to get around Shemitah. So this wasn't something new for the Sephardim. They were going along with what their Masorah was. But look, they turned to the Sephardic Beit Din because the Ashkenazic Beit Din wouldn't do this. And it's a bit ironic because all the farming settlements were Ashkenazic. There was not even one Sephardi living in the settlements. How do I know this? Because Rav El Yashar himself says that there was not one Sephardi living in the colonies. But okay. Now, I know we have a lot of lawyers listening to us now. So I think the lawyers, you'll see this. What will pop into your head? Forum shopping. You all know that if you're going to court, you try to find a good jurisdiction. You find the jurisdiction of the court that's going to favor your side. You'd be the first one at the courthouse to file your stuff there. So the state you want to hear it at hears it. And that's what we have here, basically. It's a forum shopping. You can't get the Ashkenazic Beit Din to do it, so you go to the Sephardic Beit Din. It actually is akin to what I would say shopping for a heter. You try to find, like we know they say you're not supposed to find a leniency, except when you can find a leniency. And we know that often, although lay people, they tell you not to find a heter. The fact is that rabbis look for a heter all the time and go to different post scheme if they think. And not only lay people, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein himself said that you can ask a certain posek that you feel is an expert in this area. And you look, that's how Ramosha Feinstein was asked how he became so popular. He said, because people, he was asked how a posek becomes accepted. This is a New York Times interview. And obviously he's referring to himself. He says, if people ask a question, if they like the answer, they ask more questions. Now, people went to Ramosha. They weren't going to Ramosha because he was always being machmir. Sometimes he's being machmir. But they generally assume that the odds are that they'll get a psak that they want. And then when I say psak that they want, I'm not talking about just a typical halacha question. I'm talking about a serious halacha question. When people want, let's not kid ourselves. If there's a case of mamzerus and maguna, a lot of money, there's People want the heter. If they don't get it, they accept it. That's what we do. We accept it, but we certainly hope that the rabbi rules in a way that's going to make things easier. In fact, over Shabbos, I saw a good example of this. And I know that this goes against what we're told. You're not supposed to. The example I'm going to give you is when one rabbi gives an answer, even ask another rabbi. I know we're told you're not supposed to do this, but I can give you loads of times where rabbis do this. Maybe the rabbis will say they can do it, but we can't do it. I don't know. What am I talking about, which I just read over Shabbos, and I'll tell you, well, one of our good friends here at Torah in Motion who's traveled with us, very unique person, Rabbi Tzvi Reisman. Many of you probably know the name. Very successful businessman, great Baal Tzedakah, maybe the greatest Baal Tzedakah among the Orthodox world in America, but also a Talmud Chacham of enormous proportions, who's written like 28, 29 different Sfarim. And his most recent seat. And oh, how do we know him? Why is he a good friend of ours? He's been with us on Torah in Motion trips. In fact, those who've been on the tours can remember sometimes that's maybe one of the fun parts when him and I are going at it on the bus back and forth. But he came out with a book not long after October 7th on Ratz Kesvi. That's the name of his chuvos, his halacha svarim, Lundus, but all about halacha on war. And in fact, I just saw last week that Art Scroll published a translation of it. Now, it can't be a complete translation because the actual book is like 400 pages, and the Art Scroll book, Hebrew, is much longer than English. It's only like, I think, 290 pages or something. I'd be curious if anyone's picked up the book to let me know what's in it, because if you read Rabbi Reisman's actual Sefer, he's dealing all with Muhammad, the state. Who deals with these things? You don't have so much in the Haredi world. You have some, but not so much, but you have Rav Goren deals with it, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, all these religious Zionist postschemes. So the volume focuses a lot on these authorities. I'm curious if Art Scroll was publishing all these pages that deals with Rav Goren and the other religious Zionist postscheme, even Rav Hershel Schechter and others. So if anyone has the book in the Art Scroll, let me know if you have that. But on page 153, he has the following. And this is, I guess, sort of forum shopping of the sort I just mentioned. But even in this case, forum shopping after you've already got the answer. He says that his friend, Mordechai Halpern, expert in especially in medical halacha, student of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, told the following story to him. This was some 15 years ago. He writes in this article, but I don't know when the article appeared. It's in Asya, Volume 9. It was Friday afternoon. He got a phone call, an urgent phone call. Parents on the other side of the line were very worried. Their son, who was a student at one of the yeshivas, Yeshiva Gavoa, one of the big yeshivas, was supposed to come home for Shabbos with a friend. The hour was already late. It was an hour before before sunset, and he hadn't appeared. He's nowhere to be seen. And they called the school and the yeshiva, and no one knows where he is. They say that the student was missing from yeshiva for 3 days. His tefillin is still in the room. And none of his friends, including the one who's supposed to come with him for Shabbos, have any idea where he is. Shabbos is coming, an hour before Shabbos. Rabbi Halpern says that before sunset, he was able to do two investigations. That week, there was protests in northern part of Jerusalem. I don't know. It's maybe it was the Peleg, but this is before the Peleg. But you know, these yeshiva guys protesting. I don't know if they were protesting. And the police arrested some of these protesters. So maybe he was arrested and is being kept in the jail. So Rabbi Halpern says that they contacted the Russian compound, and his name was not among the people who were arrested, and his name is not on those who had been injured or killed in car accidents in recent days. So Rabbi Halpern, right before Shkia sunset, he tells the parents of what he discovered, and Shabbos starts, and he has no answer. And the parents, as you can imagine, are dying here. They don't know what happened to their son. He says that as soon as davening was over Friday night, Maariv was over, he went to Rav Yoshev and he asked Rav Yoshev what to do. Was this considered pikuach nefesh? He says, "Ha'im mutarli? Am I permitted, or I am chuyav to start investigations to find out where the boy is, including a violation of Shabbos, getting on the phone, whatever you need to do? Is this a case of pikuach nefesh?" And Rav Yoshev thought. It says, "Rav Yoshev chashav kima." Now we should all remember that word kima, which I told you about, kufiyuv mem ayin aleph. Because remember, the Yerushalmi says that the redemption comes kima kima, a little bit, little bit. So he says, Rav Yoshev thought a little bit, and he answered, "Behechletiyut, absolutely. Who says that the boy is really in sakana, in danger? And who says that you violating the Shabbos can help him? Lachain ein lachalel at Shabbat. Therefore, Rav Yoshev says, Sheif al tase. Don't violate Shabbos. You might get on a phone call and call people and get in your car and go places. Who says you're going to be successful? One. And two, who says that the boys, it's been 3 days, but still, who says he's in Sakana?" It's hard to imagine how he couldn't be, but that's what he says. So then he says, he continues, "Shabbos morning, I went to give us Mordechai, to give a shiur, the shiur I give each week in the shul, and on the way there, I passed Shari Chesed, and I went to see Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. I got there as his davening was over, and I accompanied him to his house." So now he's going to ask Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and he'll get a different answer, but how can he ask Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach? He already asked the shaila from Rav Yoshev. And the implication here is, he's saying he asked the shaila. He wasn't just discussing it. He didn't like the answer. So look what he says. He says, I told Rav Shlomo Zalman the whole story, including the answer of Rav Yoshev. Hosafti sheineni margish benoach im atshuva. I told Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, I'm not comfortable with the answer Rav Yoshev gave me. Not comfortable. Whatever happened to the fact you're supposed to take the answer no matter what? No, he says, I'm not comfortable, especially based on the koi pikuach nefesh, the principles of pikuach nefesh, which I learned from you, Rav Shlomo Zalman. He's the student of Rav Shlomo Zalman. So what did Rav Shlomo Zalman, after thinking, Rav Shlomo Zalman said that we have to treat this as pikuach nefesh, linsoa miyad, to travel immediately and to begin all the necessary things to find the boy. Just ki'ilu yom chol hayom. Just as if today was Sunday. And I asked him, can I wait another 2 hours until my shiur is done? Because many people are coming to the shiur. He answered, absolutely no. Medubar b'pikuach nefesh v'asur b'shum panim l'dchot et hakol chiposim. He says, this is pikuach nefesh, you have to go immediately. And then he describes how he took a car he says that he gathered his brother-in-law, who's a menah ruchani in a yeshiva. They called the police. Then they went to the police station. They wanted to investigate everything, and lo and behold, they found his identity. His identity card here. No, a picture of the boy. Sorry, and that he was picked up. During the protest, it's not clear whether he was protesting, just picked up. He says, Hamachonit nishara bimkoma. The car remained where it was. In other words, they took the car. They went quickly, because Rav Shlomo Zalman said, you have to go fast. They took the car to the police station. They left the car, and then they walked and told the parents what they found, that the boy was there. And he goes on to say that this shows you the difference of opinions between the two Gedolim, that even though this might have been considered a chashash, a rachoka, or a far-fetched thing, nevertheless, Rav Shlomo Zalman said you have to violate Shabbos. Rav Yoshev had a different position. So, okay, that's a very interesting case you can discuss. My point in bringing it to you is only because of the forum shopping here. Just like the Rabbonim in Europe, they didn't like the answer from Rav Shlomo Salant, so they went to the Sardic based in. So too, Rav Mordechai Halperin wasn't comfortable, didn't like the answer of Rav Yoshev, and then he went for a second opinion, Rav Shlomo Zalman. And this isn't just a case of Pikuach Nefesh. You find many examples of people rabbonim who write about it, they were not comfortable with the psak given, and they asked someone else. And the other rav said, "Well, you can ignore that psak." In other words, sometimes you get a psak from a rav. They ask the other rav, "Well, can you overrule that psak?" Or do and the other rav will say, "You don't have to rely on that psak." So it's like you're not ignoring the psak. You're following the psak of another rabbi who says you don't have to listen to that psak. I know some people might not like that, but you have many examples of this. Okay, let's return now to the story. Rav Mulliver's great sympathy, obviously, for the settlers is seen when it comes to Hetra Mechira. The first Shemitah was 1882. There were workers already. There's the first Shemitah from the return of the Ashkenazic community, the Russian community, etc., going on Aliyah. You already have colonists there. I don't want to say colonists. I don't like that word anymore because in theory there's nothing wrong with it. But you hear all the propaganda that the state of Israel is founded by settler colonialists. So I don't want to use the word colonists. Let's I don't know. Come up with a good word. Jews returning to their homeland. So the Jews returning to their homeland begins. In terms of productive labor in 1880, before 1882. And 1882, they're all already living there, and that's the first Shemitah since the return of Jews to their homeland. There were workers living in Petah Tikva, but you didn't need a heter for them because there was malaria and other diseases, and during the Shemitah year, they had left the settlement. Because they were suffering. So it wasn't nogea, as we say. It wasn't practical. They didn't need it. But by 1889, there was an established settlement in Petah Tikva. 1888, Tishrei through 1889, there was an established settlement in Petah Tikva and other places. Now, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, in his Heter, said that only labor permitted by the Torah can be done by Jews. That labor forbidden by the Torah has to be done by non-Jews. Yes, okay, so labor that's forbidden midrabbanan from the rabbis but permitted by the Torah can be done by Jews, but labor forbidden by the Torah has to be done by non-Jews. It does seem that this distinction was not really adopted, that the heter was adopted, but no distinction was made between Torah and rabbinic prohibitions, and Jews did all the labor. That is, Jews went out into the field and actually harvested, even though that's the Torah prohibition. So although that's what Rav Yitzchak Elchanan said, we see that, for example, Rav Mulliver, he went further. And in we know that in 1895 and 96, that Shemitah year, 1895-96, that Rav Mulliver issued a psak that permitted Jews violating Torah prohibitions for the sake of Shemitah. That is, actually, it's not a violation. The land is sold. But actually doing Torah prohibitions when the land was sold. We don't have a record of Rav Mulliver stating that in the earlier Shemitah. Maybe he did. But it's possible, and this is one of the dangers, which I'm sure Rabbi the Salant was worried about in the Tziv, that you give a heter, you sell the land, and if the land is sold, you tell them, well, you can do these labors, but you can't do that, those labors, it's going to fall apart. And we know it did. We know that there were people who worked, who did even Torah prohibitions, even though Rabbi Tzolchanan said not to. But according to other poskim, this is allowed. We saw in the next Shemitah, they say this is allowed. Once the land is sold, you can. If in, I'll read you something now. Actually, no, I just summarized outside. So I don't need to, read that. Now, it was important. If you own a land, a farm, you can hire non-Jews to work in your farm, and then you're not violating Torah prohibition. But there were plenty of workers in the new Yishuvim who didn't have their own lands, so they couldn't hire non-Jews. They themselves had to work the land. And the Malacha d'Oraisa for Torah prohibition was already permitted by Rav Yashar. So although I don't have any record that Rabbi Trunk or Rav Moliver permitted it, Rav Yashar, who's based in, actually arranged the sale. His opinion was, and he told people, you can violate Torah prohibitions also once the land is sold, because it's not a problem anymore. It's not your land. So the people could rely on that. In 1889, which is the Shemitah year, Yehuda Leib Pinsker, the non-religious head of the Chovei Tzion, leaves his position, and Reb Moliver becomes the head of it, together with Rashi Finn, as he's known, Shmuel Yosef Finn of Vilna. If you see a picture of him, he looks like a big rav. He's a religious maskil. In fact, why am I, I got everything here at my fingertips here. I will, I'll be able to pull up a good picture of him here. Here you go. Here he is. Looks like a Shomer Shabbos, right? I don't know what you call him, religious maskil. He's this is what religious maskilim looked like in Vilna. Very pious Jews who would fit in very well in the German Orthodox world. He wrote a number of books, historical books, history of Vilna, about great rabbis, about the Hebrew language. So he was together also with an Avraham Greenberg of Odessa. They were head of Chovei Tzion. In the book here, I have this book, Brit Ahava V'Shalom. The book, it collects many of Reb Moliver's writings with a very nice introduction. It tells us, it has a story here from the Odessa conference of the lovers of Zion, the Chovei Tzion, in 1890. And there's a man, Yehuda Leib Appel, and he left a memoir, and he tells us that at this time, the Russian government was very opposed to any contact with Russian Jews and the land of Israel, was under Turkish control. Now, that's a problem, sending money. So he tells us that he was at Rav Moliver's house, and he woke him up, and he told him how that after some informer had told them what the Chovei Tzion were doing, that is raising money, you know, they'd raise the money and they'd send it to outside of Russia to have the money then sent. You know, there were ways to get around the restrictions, but once they were informed on, he came to Bialystok. He woke up Rav Moliver, and together they burnt. He says chavilot, stacks and stacks of michtavim, of letters and writings dealing with Chovei Tzion, all the letters between the different individuals. And he says that these things we destroyed had great value. Choma yakar v'todot tnua hatchia. He said, great, this is really the history, writings of great value about the history of Chovei Tzion in its earlier years. But it all had to be thrown out, including, he says, the contract of Ekron, Maskeret Batya. Why was this done? In case the Russian police would come and search his house and find out that the Rav of Bialystok, Rav Moliver, had been doing illegal things, arranging funds to be transferred, etc. Unfortunately, just a few months later, in the spring of 1890, the Russian government changed its position, and Chibat Zion received an official approval from the Russian government to work as an organization to support the workers of the land in the land of Israel and in Syria. So it came a couple months too late, however. Now, Rav Moliver realizes his dream in May of 1890 when he leads a group to Eretz Yisrael. He's going to see not just the Holy Land, of which he's so connected to, but also the practical results of everything they've done. And while there, he spoke of obviously the need for settling the land, and he's even praised the Yishuv HaYashan, the representatives of the old community are now on the side of Rav Moliver in support of settling the land of Israel. So next class, we'll pick up with this, because we're going to see Rav Moliver sets out even in greater detail his understanding, his vision of the land of Israel, its importance, and also what the role of the irreligious are. Many people assume that the irreligious, the land of Israel, they shouldn't have any connection. If you're not religious, don't come to the land of Israel. We already saw that Rav Moliver at first was sympathetic to that position, and then for practical reasons, he thought you couldn't throw them out if they weren't religious, but the idea that the land of Israel could be good for the irreligious, we're going to see a new approach, one that's going to have, I think, or I shouldn't say it's new, it's an approach based on sources, but a new approach, I guess, in the 19th century expressed this way, that the land of Israel is not just going to be a place for the religious, but it's also going to be a place for the irreligious, and it's even going to be the best place for the irreligious to be in the land of Israel. This is going to lead, as you can imagine, some people to have conniptions that the Holy Land will be desecrated by all the sins of the irreligious. So, I think the argument that we're going to see really has relevance even today, how you look at the land of Israel. So let me take some of the questions here and comments. Mel says, everyone in Lakewood wears their tzitzis out, which I'm assuming then goes back, maybe Rav Aaron Cutler did, or maybe he instituted it. Rav Aaron Cutler was very influenced by the Mishnah Berura. I mean, he would carry Mishnah Berura around often when he walked. And maybe he didn't assume, as Rav Ruvain said, and as the Kuntres I showed you, that the Mishnah Berura is talking about wearing the tzitzis over. Now, Rav Abadi himself from Lakewood says that's what the Mishnah Berura is referring to, the having the tzitzis over your garment. That then, if the garb is over you, then you can't put it in your pockets, because that's showing you're embarrassed by it. But if it's already underneath, then you can. But Rav Abadi himself wears the tzitzis out. He doesn't wear the garb over. He wears the tzitzis out and the garb underneath. So he obviously sees that there's an advantage to this, even though it's not based on the Mishnah Berura. And Shmuel says that my impression is that nowadays the majority of Haredim wear their tzitzis out. So it's a very interesting phenomenon. I'm assuming it's because of the Mishnah Berura. And you could argue all you want that that's not really what the Mishnah Berura means. But if you just look at the pshat of the Mishnah Berura, just look at the words, without going back to the Magen Avraham, without getting into details what really it must mean, because there's a contradiction in the Mishnah Berura. But if you just look at the very words of the Mishnah Berura, he does seem to be saying very clearly that you should wear your tzitzis out. And he doesn't distinguish between under the garb or out over the garb. Now, maybe that's what he means, over the garb. And that's the little kuntres I showed you, says that that's what he has to mean. Maybe so, but you know, we know the Mishnah Berura, I think in the yeshivisha world today, it's pretty standard, not unanimous, but pretty standard to say yiskadel. That comes from the Mishnah Berura also. So the Mishnah Berura has a great influence. And you say that you agree with my take and Reuven Feinstein's harsh response, probably annoyed that those who practice the classic way are the ones who have to defend their practices if they are going against the norm. Yeah, that's how I see it. And I mean, just think of the question. Like he's saying, it's like, from what age do we have to teach kids to wear tzitzis? I mean, that's basically what he's saying. It's the same level. He's assuming it's an obligation. And he didn't know, of course, that Reuven didn't. Ruth says, did anyone ever challenge the calculation of which year was the Shemitah year? Well, yeah, it's a dispute. I mean, you have the Rambam and the Raivad already have the dispute of which the Yovel is, right, as I recall. So that would determine then the same dispute about the Shemitah, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. As I recall, they dispute the Yovel year, which would be the Shemitah also. Did anyone ever bring up the possibility that because of a doubt as to which year we can run a lenient workaround? It's a good point. Excellent point. I don't recall. That would, you're right. If we're in doubt as to which one it is, and I'm going to check on that just to be sure, but I do believe, that we are in doubt. That would make sense. I will get back to the next class on that. If anyone does bring that up, Nissen says, why not sell to a Christian Arab? Why dafka to a Muslim? Because Christianity is avodah zarah. I'm not going to call it idolatry. It's not idolatry. They don't worship idols. Avodah Zarah means foreign worship. Idolatry is foreign worship, but there's other forms of foreign worship. And believing that God is a human being is a form of foreign worship, Avodah Zarah. So even if you assume that Christianity is a kosher religion for non-Jews, based on this idea of that non-Jews are not obligated in shituf. We've spoken many times that non-Jews don't have to believe in a pure God, divinity idea like we do. They can believe in one God divided into different parts. If that's acceptable for non-Jews, it still is not acceptable for Jews that have to have a pure view of God, and therefore, even if it would be acceptable for them, since it's not acceptable for us, therefore it would not be permitted in the Holy Land.
Does the Rabbanut adhere to this, or do they sell
Yes, yes. No,
Christianity?
absolutely, absolutely. The
Muslim.
Rabbanut would only sell it to a Druze or a Muslim,
Right.
precisely because of that reason. Rav Avad Yosef has shuvah on this. Shlomo says, isn't there a problem of going to another rabbi for heter if the previous rabbi ruled against it? Yes, that's what we're taught. And although there is a Tosfos, I'll bring it next class. So there's a Tosfos that sees this as okay. You can ask a heter. I'll bring you the Tosfos next class. There's a Tosfos that says, even if you're given a psak, you can ask another rabbi for it. But I think the way they would read this is that Rav Yoshev gives a psak. It's not like he's asking Rav Shlomo Zalman for another psak. He's asking Rav Shlomo Zalman, do I have to rely on Rav Yoshev's psak? So therefore, Rav Shlomo Zalman is actually giving a psak that you don't have to rely on Rav Yoshev. Maybe I'm just playing semantic games here. But Rav Shlomo Zalman is not really giving you psak. He's overruling and saying Rav Yoshev's psak is wrong. I mean, that could just be a semantic game I'm playing, but we do have examples of this. Look, I've mentioned it before. When people would come to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach asking about abortion, he would say, I don't come, I'm not going to give you psak because I'm machmir, go to the Tzitzel Ezer, he's makom. But let's say Rav Shlomo Zalman did give you a psak and says usser, and then you went to the Tzitzel Ezer and he says mutar. Are you bound to Rav Shlomo Zalman? In fact, some say that you can ask a second rav a psak as long as you tell the second rav that you asked the first rav, which is what Rabbi Halpern did. So in other words, you get a psak from Rav Yoshev, but then you go to Rav Shlomo Zalman and say, I already asked Rav Yoshev, but I'm not comfortable. I want to know what you have to say. There are poskim who say that as long as the second posek knows that you already asked, then the second posek can either say, well, you asked him, he's greater than me, stick with him, but he doesn't have to. MJ Frankel, the tshuvos don't need to be in conflict, you're saying. Rabbi Auerbach is being asked a day later when the risk can obviously have changed as time progresses, still not found. Okay, that's not what Rabbi Halpern thinks. Rabbi Halpern thinks that this is just a different approach, as he explains. He thinks that this is a different approach to the idea of how you view pikuach nefesh. Because he says Rav Shlomo Zalman holds that even if it's a chashash rachok, a muat, he holds that it's a nechshav kipuach nefesh. And Rabbi Halpern, who's a student of Rav Shlomo Zalman, feels that obviously Rav Shlomo Zalman, even the previous night, would have said to him, you have to go immediately. That's why he was so upset with Rav Alyoshev's answer. Shlomo says, Rav Hillel Zaks, the grandson of the Chafetz Chaim, Rosh Yeshiva Chevron, didn't wear his tzitzis out. Although he had an explanation for why he did differently in the Mishnah Berurah. Some Chevron alum I don't wear it out. Listen, I can tell you, Shlomo, that in the Radin Yeshiva, they didn't wear it out. We have Eidut Ne'amana from that, that in the Radin Yeshiva, they didn't wear it out. But now it's interesting. You say that he had an explanation why he did differently in the Mishnah Berurah. If Rabbi Zaks says that this is what the Mishnah Berurah means, but I'm not doing it, that would be significant. The question is, obviously his father didn't wear his tzitzis out, and his father is the son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim. Again, is this because this is not what the Mishnah Berurah
You
means,
know,
or yes, it's what it means?
I think it's because there are certain things Mr. Brewer wrote, but he didn't, his minhag was different than that.
You mean
So halacha, by
the Chafetz Chaim's own
the halacha
minhag?
came out, yes, the halacha came out that if called halacha is that this is what you need to do. Now his minhag was differently, so he's not going to change that.
Okay, it's a little strange though if the Chafetz Chaim is telling you that you this is the halacha, but our minhag is not to do it. The whole point of them telling you this, they're saying you should do it.
Well, someone who has no minhag, I think there's like a joke that
who has
the
no minhag?
is for someone who has no minhag.
What do you mean no minhag? I don't understand what that means. No minhag. Everyone wears clothes. The question is, do you take this out or do you take put it in? Keep it in. I don't.
There's some soldier like that
It's not like anyone had a minhag. In the Sardic world, they had a minhag not to wear it out, because Alpia Kabbalah.
In the Ashkenazic
world, no one had a minhag. They used to wear it over. Then they started wearing it under, but they didn't take the tzitzis out because they didn't have a concept of taking it out. Or later on, it thought that looked like it's not nicely dressed. You know, it's like you're not being careful with your clothes in the Musar schools. And then the Mishnah Berurah says, but you should take it out. So I don't know. It's hard. It's hard to imagine that.
There is some sefer on Birkas Shachianu that should you make it before you make the bracha on the fruit or after? And I don't remember which way he writes, but he writes the halacha is one way, the minhag is the other way.
Yes, I know we have cases like that, but I don't know if there's any. I've never seen any example where there's actually a minhag in how you wear your tzitzis. In other words, I don't know the sources that say in the Ashkenazic world that you have, like in the Musar schools, they say you don't wear it out because it's a shlump if you wear it out. But not that there's actual minhag, like the Sfardim have, Alpi Kabbalah. Is that a minhag, Shlomo, that you don't wear it out?
No, but he wouldn't be maybe machmir something his father was machmir on.
Oh, okay, I hear what you're saying, but... okay, it makes sense, maybe. I have to think about that. That's interesting. Nissan, you say...
There are a couple of scenarios like that with the Bill Zaks where he... interesting things that he wouldn't do because, like, a bracha on tzitzis, he wouldn't do. I don't know what the Mishnah rules, but the same concept. He said, my mother didn't do it with me. That's why I'm not doing it.
Yeah, no, like, I know we have examples of that, but usually you have a code of Jewish law. The code is... you put it down there, you can have an exception. You say, unless your minhag is otherwise, but if you just set it forth in a code. I mean, we have examples, incidentally, where the Shulchan Aruch HaRav has things that we know, at least according to Chabad tradition, he didn't do. So I don't know. It could be. That could be a good point. Nissen says that Syria, Palestina, established by Roman Emperor Hadrian in the 2nd century when he incorporated the former Judea under its new name, remained as one unit under Ottoman Turkey and so was recognized by this Russian government. You know, the terms Palestine, we all know that it was Rome changed the name to destroy Jewish nationalism from Judea, although they didn't invent it. It's not like Rome invented it. Herodotus mentions an area which they called Palestine, but it wasn't the name of an official name of a territory. It was like the, it was, but it was so the term itself was known. I'm not sure why you said that though, Nissan. What your point was
because you when you read the your recording of the permission of the new government, it said the Jews to settle in Syria.
Eretz Yisrael and Syria. What Syria
right.
there means?
I don't think they said Eretz Yisrael. I don't know. I don't know what
No, that's what he read. That what I read to you is he said. I'll read it again.
But you did read in Syria.
He said that it's the name. It's called the Organization of Supporting of the Adama of Eretz Yisrael in Syria. So I guess that's the parallel to it. But Syria also would.
That must be where they got it from.
Northern Israel and Lebanon. Parts of Lebanon we know are Eretz Yisrael, and yet that was known as Syria. In fact, wait, next week you'll see that there's a Jewish community in Beirut, and Rav Molliver actually recommends, because not everyone goes to Israel, we can also go to Lebanon, and we can settle there because the land is good, and I don't get any ideas, these right-wingers in Israel. It's hard enough to me in my mind that they're talking about going back to Gaza. But there's been a few who's actually said, maybe we should just keep southern Lebanon. I mean, I don't know what planet these people are on. But okay, we've spoken enough today. Thank you all. Thank you very much, Shlomo, for that very interesting point and for your email as well to me earlier. And Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, Lila Tov, thank you. All right, Rabbi Shulman, of course, tomorrow with his regular class on Yoshua, and Rabbi Helfgott on Wednesday. Thursday, of course, Shuli Mishkan is beginning a new series on archaeologists in the land of Israel. That's Thursday at noon, and everybody should be well, and good news. And yeah, okay, I can, yeah. All right, that's it. Laila tov, everybody, and see you soon. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.